listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. Sorry, I got tripped up because we're actually recording this one in person.
In person.
It's a throwback to the way this podcast started. We've been doing a lot of recording from our own separate homes and under certain circumstances, we had to record in person this time, and I'm excited for it.
Yeah.
All right, so...
I'm also excited to talk about our game this week, because yes. It was actually requested by a listener.
That's right. Thank you, listener, for requesting that we play this game. If you'd like to request that we play any particular game, feel free to drop us a line. You can use our form on our website, bgbcast.com, or you can hit us up on social media, and be sure to let us know whether or not you want us to mention your name, if you do so.
Of course.
Okay, so we got another regularly scheduled weekly episode, except it's not regularly scheduled because it's a bit delayed, but it's not weekly. I stopped saying that a while ago.
Yeah.
Okay, we got another episode. We're going to talk about a board game. Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Clank, designed by Paul Denon and published in 2016 by Renegade Game Studios.
Okay, so Clank. So we're going to talk about Clank this episode. We're going to start out with a short description of what Clank is about. Then we'll get into the rules. Then we'll talk about strategies. And then at the end of the episode, we're going to talk about design. So for a short description on what Clank is about, in Clank, players attempt to sneak into a dragon's lair in a competition to see who is the greatest thief. You do this by building a deck from which you draw and play cards. Each turn, you must draw and play 5 cards, which will give you resources that you can use to move through the dungeon, fight monsters, purchase goods from the shop, and acquire new cards to add to your deck. As you play cards, some of them may add Clank, which makes you vulnerable to the wrath of the dragon. After all players have either escaped with treasure or been knocked out by the dragon, the player with the most combined points from cards, items, and gold wins. So that's a basic description on how Clank is played. It's sort of like a dungeon crawler, but built around a deck builder. So let's get into the specifics of how Clank is played, and then we'll talk about strategies. Okay?
Yeah.
So first, why don't we talk about the resources that the cards give you in the game?
Yeah. So at the start of the game, you have 10 cards in your deck, right? I believe. And I want to say 6 of those give you just one resource called skill.
Yes, I believe you have... Yeah, 6 of those, and then there's 2 stumbles, which just make Clank, and then there's another 2 cards. I can't remember the names of.
Right.
Yes. And we should mention, by the way, so you draw 5 cards per turn, and you have to play all 5 of them, or you have to play all the cards in your hand. Sometimes you might draw more cards, you have to play those too. So if a card mostly has negative effects, you have to play it.
Right, yes. So skill is a blue resource, and it allows you to buy more cards to put into your deck. There is a sort of trade row of 6 cards, and 2 of the card types that can appear in this trade row can be put into your deck by paying skill. There's also 4 sort of basic cards that can always be bought, and 3 of them can be put into your deck via skill.
Mm-hmm. So skill is one of the 3 main resources that the cards that you play on your turn will generate. The next resource that they could generate is swords, which is a sort of representation of your combat power. And swords serve 2 purposes. The first purpose is that they are used to defeat monsters that will appear in the trade row. There's also, like you mentioned, that 4th card off to the side that's always available, and that is a monster that you can defeat with 2 swords. The monsters that you find in the deck, they will take anywhere from 1 to, I've seen like 5, 4 yeah. or 5 swords. And generally, I guess maybe it could help to say, like, the cards that you start with in your deck don't give you any swords. The ones that give you skill only give you 1 skill, and you can, some of those basic cards that you can buy always will give you 2 swords and 1 skill when you play them. So that's swords. When you defeat a monster, you will get a benefit, but you do not put that monster card in your deck. Monsters that are defeated are always placed in the trade row discard pile or the dungeon deck discard pile. That is with one exception being the goblin, which is that 4th card that's off to the side with all of the other basic cards that are always available for purchase. If you defeat the goblin stays right there.
Yeah. So, and then the last sort of main resource you can get on cards is boots, which allow you to move around the dungeon. Mm-hmm. So in the center of the table is this big web of a board of sort of interconnected spaces with hallways between them. And the boots allow you to move between spaces through the hallways.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, it takes one boot to move through a hallway to the next space connecting to it. Some hallways have two boots on them, which means you have to spend two boots to move through them. Some of them have monster symbols, which means you either spend swords to pass through that hallway safely alongside the boots, or you take damage, which we'll explain in a moment.
Right, and that's the other purpose of swords that I mentioned earlier, how they have two purposes. One of them is to defeat monsters that appear on cards, and the other is to defeat those monsters on those passageways that you move right. through. So the dungeon is made up of a number of chambers, like you mentioned, and these chambers are connected by these pathways. There's a couple things to note about these chambers. First of all, the whole dungeon is split a little over halfway down the middle, where the bulk of the chambers are in this underneath part of the dungeon. I can't remember. Do you know the term for that?
I don't remember.
Well, it's this like lower portion where most of the rooms can be found. And then there's this upper portion. Players enter the dungeon from off of the board near the top, which is that upper area. They pass through the upper area to get to the lower area, and the lower area is where much of the action happens. And then another thing to be pointed out about the dungeon is that the arrows don't always go both ways, or the passages don't go both ways. Sometimes a passage could be an arrow, which is only a one-way trip. And then one more thing is that some of the rooms are these crystal caverns, and if you enter a crystal cavern, then you cannot exit the crystal cavern on your turn.
Right, so you have to wait another turn before you can move out of it.
Mm-hmm. And that means that if you have extra boots, you are unable to use them to pass to another cavern or to another chamber in the dungeon.
Right.
Okay, so let's talk about the goal of the game, because there's... So you buy and play these cards, but why are you buying and playing these cards? The answer is to earn points, and there's a couple different ways to earn points, but the most common ways are A, the cards that you purchase from the trade row and put into your deck can sometimes earn you points at the end of the game. I don't know why I did an ABC. Two, I'm going to switch it to a numbered system.
Nice.
Two, there's gold in the game. So if you defeat the goblin, the reward is you get one gold. And then other effects in the game will give you gold. And then the third and the primary, or I guess the focus of the game, the third way to earn points is via artifacts. So scattered throughout the dungeon in very intentionally placed locations, only in the underground portion of the dungeon are these cardboard tokens that represent artifacts that belong to the dragon. And each player may only hold one artifact. Once you've chosen to pick up an artifact, you cannot set it back down. So you're stuck with that artifact for the rest of the game. There's a sort of exception to that rule when we talk about the shop. We'll get to that later. So the main focus of this game and sort of your goal as the dungeon robber in this game is to get to an artifact, pick it up, and then exit the dungeon while holding the artifact. So artifacts can be worth anywhere from 5 to 30, 35 points, something like that. I think 30 might be the maximum. So 30 points is a lot in this game's math. And if you are able to collect an artifact and leave the dungeon without being knocked out by the dragon, then you get 20 bonus points.
Yes, which is also quite a lot in this game's math.
Mm-hmm. So speaking about artifacts, we can also talk about another mechanic in this game, which are the major and minor secrets. So littered also throughout the dungeon in various rooms, this time rooms that could be above ground or below ground, are these other tokens that are shuffled up and placed face down. And these are major and minor secrets, and you can tell the difference because the major secrets are much larger tokens than the minor secrets. And when you enter a room that has any token in it, whether it be a secret or a artifact or something else, you get to choose one type of token and pick one of them up and keep it. So obviously, if you choose artifact, that's the artifact you've chosen. You can't put it back down. If you choose a secret, then you flip it face up and you take it in front of you, and then you perform whatever action it says. Some secrets can earn you points. Some secrets can anger the dragon. Usually I think they do both. And some secrets can give you like a one-time use effect that can maybe heal you or give you a small boost in movement or skill for the turn. And then the major secrets do that, but to a greater extent.
Right.
I guess we should mention now that any resources that you get from cards on your turn is lost at the end of your turn. So if you don't spend all of your skill or use all of your movement, you don't get to save that till the next turn.
Right. The only resource that you preserve between turns is gold.
Mm-hmm.
So gold, you get those little like tokens. You get them from mainly defeating monsters. Some cards that you buy with skill will later give you gold as well. And not only is gold worth victory points at the end of the game, but there are four bazaar or market spaces on the board in the dungeon, in the underground section, that when you're on one of those spaces, you can spend 7 gold to buy an item.
Mm-hmm.
There are 4 items. There is the crown, which I believe is mainly worth victory points.
Yeah, it's only worth victory points, and it's like the sooner you grab a crown, the more points it'll be worth. The first crown bought in the game is worth 10 points, then 9, then 8.
There are some cards that say, like, if you have a crown, you do a better effect,
mm-hmm.
but those are very few and far between. There is the backpack, which lets you hold another artifact.
Yeah,
this is the... again, you can only... once you pick up an artifact, you can't drop it.
Right. This is the only other way to hold 2 artifacts. You can only hold a maximum of 2 artifacts, I'm pretty sure.
I'm not sure.
Maybe you can't. Maybe you can buy multiple backpacks to hold multiple artifacts, but that would have to be a really long game where you got really lucky with the draws from the bag.
Yeah.
And then the third artifact, or the third thing that you can buy from the shop, is a key. Some of the hallways in the dungeon have a little lock symbol on them, and that's just to say that you cannot pass through that hallway unless you have a key. Usually these lock symbols only gate a shortcut. They do not block you from going to a room with, like, something that would normally be inaccessible, I think. There's a couple rooms that are inaccessible unless you have a key.
Yeah. They do also, key hallways never have any other symbols.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need to, like, spend a key and pay swords or stuff like that.
Right.
So it's usually quicker and easier once you have the key mm-hmm. to move around.
It should be mentioned that you don't spend the key. You get to keep the key, and it just unlocks all the hallways for you.
Mm-hmm.
And keys and backpacks are also worth points. They're just worth fewer points than the crowns are worth.
Yes.
I think they're worth like 4 and 3 points each. Okay, so let's talk about what the game is called and why it's called that.
Yes.
So I think the explanation for it is that the clank is the sound of like your armor clanging together, and that will alert the dragon in a sense. So every player has a pile of cubes that matches the same color as their player pawn, the thing that they are moving through the dungeon. So if you have the blue pawn, you have a bunch of blue cubes. And whenever you generate clank through your cards, you place however many clank you've generated, you place that many cubes in a pile on the board. They have a special section where you place your cubes. And then periodically throughout the game, the dragon will attack. And this happens whenever you refresh the trade row. So you'd mentioned, Matthew, there's 6 cards in the trade row. If you buy any of them, at the end of your turn, they are replenished back up to 6 cards. And when you do that, if any of the cards that you replenished into the trade row have little dragon symbols on them, then a dragon attack occurs before the next player's turn begins. So when a dragon attack occurs, you take all of the cubes that are in the clank pile and you put them in a bag. The bag starts out with a bunch of black cubes in it, and you will add cubes of the various players' colors to it. So you add the cubes to the bag, and then you shake the bag up, and then there's a tracker that tells you how many cubes you draw from the bag. I think it starts at 2, and then as you do things to irritate the dragon, like steal the dragon's artifacts, you will start to draw more cubes. And some cards, if they show up in the trade row, might cause even more cubes to be drawn. So it starts at 2, but it can get up there. So you draw cubes from the bag, and if you draw a cube that matches a player's color, then it goes onto that player's health tracker, which has 10 spaces. So after 10 of a player's cubes have been drawn, that player is knocked out.
Right. Additionally, when you take damage from the hallways that have monster heads on them, you put those cubes from your own supply onto the health tracker.
Yes.
Meaning that that will still make you closer to actually dying.
Mm-hmm. So this all comes down to, like, Clank causes the dragon to attack you more often or makes it more likely for you to take damage from the dragon. So you should be slightly careful about that because you don't want to get knocked out. Because what happens if you get knocked out, if you don't have an artifact yet, like you haven't picked one up yet, or if you do have an artifact, but you are in the underground portion of the dungeon, if you get knocked out, then you don't score points from any artifacts that you may or may not have. And you are removed from the game and you don't get the bonus 20 points for getting out alive. If you're knocked out above ground and you have an artifact, you get to score your artifact at the end of the game, however many points it was worth. But you do not get to take the 20 bonus point chip.
Right.
You only get the 20 bonus point chip if you made it out alive with an artifact.
Right. Now, the first player to make it out alive with an artifact starts a countdown.
Or the first player to be knocked unconscious.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the countdown begins the first time somebody is removed from the board. Either it's because they left, because they had an artifact, or because they were knocked out.
Right. This countdown, every turn on that player's turn, instead of taking their normal turn, they basically cause the dragon to attack.
Mm-hmm.
And on the next turn, and then the turns afterwards, you draw more cubes from the dragon's bag.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a higher chance of people taking damage or taking more damage
mm-hmm.
as that timer progresses.
Yes. And then on the fourth turn, everyone who's still in the dungeon is just knocked unconscious by the dragon. And that's right. The end of the game. There's no avoiding that knockout.
Right. And the rest of the rules for scoring points based on where you are and what you have mm-hmm. applies.
Right. So that's how the game ends. It's either somebody leaves the dungeon and triggers this countdown clock, or someone gets knocked out and begins the countdown clock, or everyone gets out or gets knocked out just naturally. Those are the sort of four ways that the game can end. Okay, and that's pretty much everything you need to know. I guess there's one card type that we should mention. I think you mentioned there's two kinds of cards you can buy with skill. I guess there's three kinds of cards because there's the common cards that are always available. Those have a yellow banner. There's the blue cards that have a blue banner that you buy with skill. Those go into your discard pile, which then goes into your deck. So you're basically adding them to your deck. And then there's the purple cards, which are like events or like one-time effect things. These cards don't go into your deck. They just go into the dungeon deck discard pile. Okay, so strategy.
Yes.
So I think I can point out sort of like three high-level strategies that sort of emerged when we were playing.
Sure.
That I think each one just kind of revolves around one of the primary resources in a way. So there's... I've given them names, I think. Grab and go... Max money, max skill is, I guess, how I would differentiate them.
Sure.
So the grab and go focuses on movement, on boots. They're trying to get into the dungeon, get relatively deep, grab a pretty good artifact, and then leave as fast as possible, thereby triggering the end game and punishing any player that has taken their time
right.
or has sort had of, unlucky draws.
Sort of your rush strategy.
Yeah, this is like the aggro strategy
yeah.
in like a different like competitive card game.
Yeah, this does also let you get to a lot of those secrets first.
Yeah, the major and minor secrets, which can sort of compound, especially if you find secrets that give you move speed.
Right.
So that's one strategy. It gives you the artifact, it gives you the bonus points, and hopefully it knocks your opponents out when they're below ground so that they don't get any bonus points, nor do they get to steal their skill score their artifact. Okay, next idea for a strategy, maximum money. This is probably mostly focused on swords as the primary resource from the cards that they draw, but also money. It's just swords will convert to money a lot
right.
of the time.
To gold.
To gold, right. So first of all, at the end of the game, each gold is worth 1 point. So there's a lot of points to be gained if you just save up a lot of gold. But then also you can go to the shop and you can change a pile of 7 gold into a crown worth 10 points. So you've earned 3 points that way. Also you can afford the backpack, which lets you carry 2 artifacts, which is the final part of this strategy with max money, is that you can hold 2 artifacts.
Right.
So, you know, it can probably make up for if you didn't get out of the dungeon. You can make up for that lost 20 points as long as you got two artifacts, you have a bunch of gold, and you manage to get at least above the underground portion. But if you do manage to get all the way, then this is a lot of points that you're getting from your tokens and your items.
Right. It should be worth noting that because the goblin can be fought any number of times, it pretty much means that for every two swords you have, you can get one gold per turn.
Mm-hmm.
Every two swords per turn, I mean. And also, two swords just helps you get through the dungeon if you have a pretty good capacity or whatever. Because, you know, two swords is what you need to get through any given hallway with monsters. You know, one to two, but... Mm-hmm. So if you have two swords every turn and you don't need to move through a hallway, that's a point. And if you do have to move through a hallway, then you've done so safely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is definitely the sort of like safe bet route.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it you could take much longer than the other two strategies that I'll outline, like the one I've just outlined in the next one. Just because you'll be spending a lot more time in the underground area if you're trying to get the backpacks and the second artifact. But if you're just happy with all the gold you've got, maybe you get a crown, you get a decent artifact, and then you make your way out, that could probably still be worth it. And wouldn't be too risky. Okay, the last one is... Oh, I one more point about maximum money and swords is that you're probably not buying a lot of cards from the trade row, which means your deck would be pretty trim throughout the game.
Right, you would have lower victory points from your cards then.
Yes.
So that is an important trade-off.
Yeah, hopefully you're making up for it through victory points from items and coins and artifacts and what have you. Okay, so the final is max skill, where you're just attempting to get as much skill on any given turn as possible. And you're converting this skill into cards that go into your deck, and those cards will be worth points at the end of the game.
Right.
So you're buying all the cards in the trade row that have like a victory point attributed to them, or you're buying a bunch of cards that just help you draw cards. You know, this strategy will end up with the tallest stack at the end of the game, so you're going to need a bunch of tools to dig through it on a given turn so that you can make more skill. I mean, card draw already leads to more skill on a turn because on average a card in your deck will give you skill instead of any other kind of resource.
Right.
And then there's one of the common cards, which we haven't really gone over exactly what they do, but one of them is a book that costs 7 skill to acquire, which is a lot of skill, and it's worth 7 points at the end of the game, which is a decent amount of points.
Right, yeah. I was also going to say that in the deck there are a bunch of gems, which also provide a lot of flat victory points. I don't think the gems have an ability. Some of them might give you skill. I don't really remember. But those give you, like, I think from 5 to 10 victory points.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, yeah, skill lets you get, you know, cards that do things. And even if you're doing the other two strategies, you want to work in extra skill just because there are very good cards in the trade row.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so when we last played, I ended up winning, and part of that was because I had a lot of skill I was able to produce every turn to buy, like, 2 or 3 cards near the end of the game that saved me from dying. One of them was, like, a magic carpet that let me pass through crystal caves in a turn.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, if you just had movement, then you might get caught in a cave, for example. Or you might not have been able to buy a really useful card when it came up.
Yeah.
Because the trade row is first come, first serve. Mm-hmm. There's not a very, like it feels like there aren't many copies of most cards in the trade row deck, in the dungeon deck.
Yeah.
Like, there are some that there are at least 3 copies, maybe more, but most of the cards don't have many copies, and yeah. So...
most of the cards are pretty unique.
Being able to get the cards, you know, on your turn that you want... and not having to skip on something good.
Mm. There's also just a lot of cards in the trade row.
So yeah.
There's low probabilities of drawing any specific card. So if a good one comes across, it's best to snatch it up. And the maximum skill strategy manages to do that better than anybody else.
Now, so in deck builders, trashing is usually a pretty good thing. In this game, there's not much trashing, or aka the ability to remove cards from your deck.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when you do, it is the one skill card is specifically the one that you're able to get rid of. It is hard to get rid of the stumbles in your deck. So I kind of think this is a deck builder where bloat is pretty good. Because since trashing is so hard to come by, it's better to just have a higher quantity of good cards to sort of draw into instead.
Yeah.
And it will make you draw stumbles less frequently, which means you're going to take less damage or have a chance to take less damage.
Yeah, yeah. Since it's hard to take the bad cards out of your deck, then it's better to just put a ton of good cards into your deck.
Right.
So that it's less likely that you draw a bad card.
Especially the stumbles.
Especially the stumbles, which are cards that do nothing except add one clank.
Yeah. Clank management, I think, is a underappreciated element.
We didn't see a lot of anti-clank or negative clank. You did?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't. I guess you were taking up all the anti-clank cards from the trade row, because I don't think anybody else that was playing with us got any cards that removed clank. So there some lots of cards will add clank. Like sometimes there's a card that will have a really big effect, like you draw a lot of cards or get a lot of resources, but then it'll add clank in some amount as a downside. But there's also cards that add negative clank, which if you've added clank or if you have any cubes in the clank pile and you gain negative clank, then you get to take those cubes back.
Right. It is kind of swingy because you can only take the cubes back if they're in that pool, not if they're in the bag.
Right.
But like I was able to, there's a solid string of dragon attacks where I never got a cube drawn because I just had so few cubes in the bag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had you did have, by the end of the game, the exact amount needed to kill you. We just didn't draw them at the end of the game. There was a chance, though.
Sure.
So it's not to say that negative clank prevented you, made you immortal, but yeah, it did help your chances.
Yeah.
But like you said, like you only can use negative clank if you have cubes in the pile, and depending on how many players you're playing with, you might not get that opportunity. Like, if you put cubes in it in your previous turn, that it comes back around to you and there hasn't been a dragon attack.
Right.
Maybe it's easier early on. So, like, a negative clank card is probably more useful at the beginning of the game. Both, like, because your opponents probably won't be buying so many cards from the trade row, meaning there's less opportunities for a dragon symbol to appear. And then also your deck is, like, mostly stumbles, or has more stumbles.
Yeah.
Proportionally. So negative clank gets a little bit worse throughout the game, depending on the other cards you bought. I guess if you have bought a bunch of those cards that have negative or that give you clank as a downside because their upside is so big, then getting a couple of those anti-clank cards could be worth your time.
Right. I think with fewer players, it's better because with more players, more people are buying cards, which means more chances for dragon attacks to show up.
Yeah.
And fewer players, fewer cards bought. Fewer cards getting cycled from the deck.
Right. So I think, like, thinking about the game, the strategy for acquiring a bunch of cards is probably one of the stronger ones. It's definitely what won you the game when we played. But I do want to point out, like, if you aren't going for the quick exit, then you just need to be aware if somebody is going for it. Because a quick exit triggering the end of the game when you're not ready will spell your defeat. Like, it was about a 10-point difference between you and the next person. You know, if you hadn't made it out alive, somebody else would have won.
Right.
And you only made it out alive because you were in a position to leave when the end game was triggered.
Right.
And you did start to buy a lot of cards that helped you get out.
Right.
You know, towards the end of the game. So yeah, you prepare in two ways. You got to position yourself in the dungeon in a place where you can escape, and you have to try to acquire some cards leading up to that end game clock that when you draw into them, you know, next time you draw cards, that'll help you escape as well.
Right. The biggest thing, I think, is knowing or having a way to deal with the crystal caves, because I believe the only path that doesn't go through a crystal cave requires a key, as far as going from the underground to the surface. Every other path passes through one crystal cave.
Yes.
So you need to at least have a turn set aside for stopping there. Or you have to have, like, an item or a secret or a card that lets you get through it.
Yeah, there are a couple ways to get through a crystal cave and keep moving. So yeah, be on the lookout for that if you think you're sort of trailing behind. Or I guess if you are looking to make a quick exit, then having that is good because it can get you out of the upper area a turn sooner and catch people by surprise.
Right.
Maybe even two turns sooner if you use it to get through two different caves on one turn after the other.
If you can't get to the top at all, then I would at least just recommend buying a bunch of secret tomes.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can hopefully get roughly 28 points.
Yeah, I think, what do you think if you get 7 skill, like, should you just get a secret tome? Like, maybe, let's assume that there is a, let's talk two scenarios. One, there is a card that costs like 6 skill in the trade row that does something good. Two, there isn't a card in the trade row. Like, should, is it better to buy a 3 cost and a 4 cost instead of the tome sometime during the game?
3 costs and 4 costs, I think it depends on how good those actually are. And also, I think it depends on how close the game is to ending. If it's early enough, then I would take the 3 and 4 cost for the better spread of good cards in my deck.
Especially if one or both of them are worth points.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because having more good cards in your deck to break up the bad cards is pretty good.
Yeah.
Whereas I think if it's late game where somebody is either left or is about to leave, I would get the tome just because the 7 points can start adding up quicker.
Mm-hmm. All right. Do you have anything else? I guess one thing to point out, there are 3 rooms and at least the main version of the board that can heal you. So like kind of plan a route for that if your health is getting a little high. And then I think your other best chance of getting healed is through minor secrets. So just like hunt those down if your health is getting a little too high.
Right.
But otherwise, yeah. Otherwise, just try not to add too many clank.
We didn't even mention the monkeys.
Oh, yeah. There's
a room with 3 like treasures in it. And when you enter it, you can pick up one of them. And right. Each one is worth bonus points.
Yes. So that's another way. They're somewhat deep in the caves, but they're not gated behind like locked doors or anything. It's not impossible to get to them.
Right.
You can actually get to them pretty quickly. You just have to go through some monsters.
Right.
All right. So before we talk about, wait, do you have anything else strategy?
No, not really.
All right. So before we talk about the design, let's take a quick trip to the plug house.
Plug.
I don't want to say zone.
Yeah.
The plug tub.
Yeah.
Let's
know
take
about
a dip
that.
In the plug tub.
I don't know about that.
All right. Well, we'll think about it some more. But for now, we have a tentative title. Okay. Here we go. All right. So like we mentioned at the top of the episode, you can follow us on social media and Facebook and Twitter at BG Broscast. And that's where you can interact with us, hit us up with suggestions for games, you know, drop us a follow, drop us a like, whatever you feel like. That's where you can find us on social media. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com. Where we have all of our episodes posted and cataloged and tagged. You can use our neat search function to find episodes where we talked about the games or you want to hear our thoughts. And if you don't find that episode, then that means we probably haven't talked about it on our podcast. So again, you can hit us up with a suggestion. You can do that on our website too, on our About Us page. I believe there's a contact form you can fill out. Sends us an email with your suggestions. And also on our website, you can find a link to our TeePublic store. That's teepublic.com/user/BGBcast. And that's where you can get some merch with our cool plugs on it.
Yeah, our cool logos on it. Not our plugs.
I mean, it is sort of a plug when
sort
you think
of.
About it.
Sort of. You can also follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming, where I tweet about what I'm working on, sort of any funny ideas that happen to pop in my head, ahaha. But you can check out like my stream there. I stream on twitch.tv/twack, twitch.tv/twak. I stream on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday from about 1 p.m. Central Time to 3 or 4 p.m. Central Time. I stream roguelites, competitive games. Every Friday I stream Hitman, and people in chat can use channel points to mess with me. I'll probably be streaming the new Teamfight Tactics expansion, since that is out and it's very good.
Very good.
So, yeah, check that out if you're interested in checking out a stream.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find my other podcast, Net Surfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web,
Not bad.
Where me and my co-host Galen talk about interesting media from the 21st century. We just got done with our spooky month where we talked about interesting video game based web series such as Ben Drowned and Pets Cop. So if any sort of stuff like that interests you, we've talked about mashup albums, vaporwave music, bad video games, good video games, weird video games, internet reviewers. We've reviewed reviewers. So check that out if you're interested in interesting media and more podcasts.
All right. NetSurfer Pro.
Mm-hmm.
And if you'd like, you can follow me on Twitter at Jeff Craig Designs. All right, let's return to the discussion on Clank. Let's talk about the design of... Yeah, speaking of design, let's talk about Clank's design.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that would have been so good to say. All right. So, Clank is a deck builder
mm-hmm.
and a dungeon delver.
Yeah.
And it uses the deck to interact with the dungeon, which I think... At a glance is a pretty cool concept that it's just like it's kind of mashing together two kind of board game concepts or tabletop gaming concepts, and it does so in a relatively successful way.
Right. I feel like so this was released in 2016. I feel like nowadays there are a lot more games that use deck building as just a mechanic and not a feature.
Mm-hmm.
This feels sort of like the transitional period of like designers exploring more the idea of using deck building as a mechanic to facilitate something else.
Yeah.
But in Clank, it definitely does feel like more of a part of the game than, I don't know, other deck builders.
Right. I think if I had learned Concordia. Of Clank, like, in 2016, I would have been like, oh, that's so interesting that, like, the cards don't just give you a resource that adds more cards to your deck. Because that's what all the other deck builders had been doing at that point. It's just like, it's the deck builder, you play cards that build your deck, and that's it. Like, the cards just build your deck, and that's the only mechanic in the game. So it's cool that, like, you could play a card, and it doesn't do anything that would add something to your deck, but instead, it just makes you move. Or it makes you attack, you know?
Yeah.
That's a super interesting concept. It's like you're playing Dungeons & Dragons with a deck, and you're leveling up by adding cards to your deck. So yeah, I think it's a really neat concept, especially for the time that it came out. And I think the way that the mechanics or the resources, like, kind of overlap is done pretty well in this game. Personally, I think that they kind of... Like we've mentioned that, you know, you could try to specialize in one or the other, you know, resource, try to build a deck that generates one resource better than the other players. But you will just, as a result, generate all kinds of resources and sort of do similar things to the other players to extent. So, like, for example, you have skill. You start out with skill in your deck. You use that skill to buy maybe swords, maybe movement. You use the swords and the movement to get through the dungeon. You might encounter minor secrets, which gives you more skill or more swords or movement.
Do secrets give skill?
Yeah. Okay. I think there's some one-time use secrets that will give you skill. They'll give you all three of these have methods to get you points. You know, the swords give you money, which you can then spend. So there's some cards that you can spend money on to get certain effects. Yeah, and the swords help you move, the skills give you cards that make you move better through the dungeon. I don't know, I think everything just kind of comes back to the point of the game pretty well, I guess. Maybe they don't overlap or, like, really interact with each other in very unique ways, but they do all kind of point back to what you should be doing in the game.
Right, so I think the way I would put it is I get what the designer was going for. So, like, I can definitely see ways where the three main resources interact in some way. Like, the market is a combination of boots and swords,
because mm-hmm.
you need swords to get the gold mainly, and you need boots to get there in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And then the two of the items you get are improvements to boots, essentially. Backpack improves boots because it lets you get another artifact, which ties into movement, and the key is an improvement to boots because it lets you move more places.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, so I don't think the secrets are plentiful enough to really count as the boots going towards other systems.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like secrets are kind of there as a bonus, but not really something you can work towards as like part of your plan.
Yeah, I guess maybe they're sort of like they're maybe meant to make one turn have an interesting decision, not really meant to make your whole game plan have interesting decisions.
It's more like getting an item in, like, I don't know, Mario Party, if that makes sense. Where I guess Mario Party is not a good example, but it's like
Mario Kart,
maybe. Yeah. Where you get something random and it generally helps you, but to what degree it helps you and in what avenue it lets you progress, it's not really guaranteed. I do think also that skill itself is kind of so fundamental. They kind of tell you this by making your deck only start with skill and I think movement.
Yeah, but the movement only appears on one card.
Yeah. It kind of tells you, like, hey, skill is really good, you should get it.
Sorry, maybe two cards. It might be two cards.
Because you can't really add more cards to your deck with swords or boots. And swords and boots will also miss out on victory points because of that. Because you can at least get, you know, 1 to 3 victory points every turn using skill. So the other thing is that since the monsters are in the same deck as the cards that cost skill, if you're only building swords or mainly building swords, you're probably not going to get as many chances to use them on, like, good effects compared to people who are using skill to buy cards.
Although I will say that if you're not focusing on swords, then it can be hard to have enough to defeat those monsters when they show up in the trade row.
Yeah.
And there's really not a lot of effects in this game that remove cards from the trade row, just like putting them in the discard pile just to get things going again. So I think we played the whole game. There was like this crystal monster in the trade row that was there almost until the end of the game. So yeah, this crystal monster was in the trade row for the whole game. So I don't think there was any shortage of monsters in the trade row.
Right. Okay, so that's sort of, it reminds me of Ascension, where, like, you have a trade row with two resources. It means that if you do specialize in one, you won't be able to do the other.
Yeah.
But if you don't specialize, then there will be cards that just remain there the whole time, because they're too expensive. I feel like...
But I think to your point, like, it's definitely more skill-costed cards than sword-costed cards in the deck.
Right.
So, you know, maybe that one sits there, but once you defeat it, it could be a while till another one shows up.
Right. And swords don't really do much other than get you gold. So, like, you need them to pass through the tunnels with monsters, but you also need boots. And, you use them to fight monsters in the trade row, but those are kind of few and far between. And the goblin gives you 1 gold. And while that is 1 point, it doesn't get you anywhere closer to an artifact or substantial points in that regard. And so it feels like swords are kind of, like, attacked on necessity at times. I don't think they're super well designed.
Okay.
In the same way that skill allows you to go into any other resource, and boots are necessary to finish the game.
Gotcha. Okay.
I think you could beat the game, or not beat, but win the game without any swords. You know, I don't know about the other players, but, like, you could avoid the hallways with monsters, and you could avoid buying monster cards or fighting monster cards because skill gives you a lot of points and boots let you get artifacts.
Yeah. It could be just a matter of balance and, like, just fine tuning to make swords feel just as impactful as skill. I think I get where you're coming from, that it doesn't feel like swords are as good a resource as the other two.
Right.
And I think I am appreciating, though, that, like, you can get by with one or the other, but you do need some combination of both, less so with swords. Like, if you don't have skill, then you do have a tough time. If you don't have swords, it's not that bad.
Right.
I am kind of appreciative now, like, from this conversation, of just how, like, swords and boots have a real strong connection with each other. Not so much swords and skill or boots and skill.
Right. Swords and skill is just, like, you can get any card in the trade row, and boots and skill is just move fast.
Yeah, move fast and die young,
I guess. Now, so I think the other thing about swords that makes them feel weird to me is the whole, like, deck bloat problem. Because I was talking about how it seems like a good strategy to add cards to your deck to avoid drawing as many stumbles as often. And So let me back up a bit. I have a lot of biases when it comes to deck builders. Mm-hmm. I'm one of those people who thinks Dominion is still the best deck builder made. And I think Clank isn't a deck builder in the same way Dominion is. And that's okay. And I'm trying to deal with that as I'm reviewing the
game.
This
is a real reckoning for you.
Yeah.
I mean, this is... So just the fact that cards cost... Or cards earn you points. I think just including that in a deck builder encourages people to just bloat their decks up.
Yeah, that's like the Cryptozoic deck builders, you know.
And you enjoy a deck builder that sort of like gamifies the process of actually building like a competitive deck for a competitive game.
Right.
You like
a more tight deck.
Yeah, you like trimming and making this very, very this very fine-tuned combo deck by the end of the game that does something really, really well, and it does it really, really consistently. But yeah, when cards are worth points, then in addition to there being like very scarce resources for trimming your deck in this game, you're really encouraged just to fill your deck up with as many cards as you can, especially the ones that are worth points, because like those you don't lose those by the end of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you die in the pits of the dungeon, like as long you get to score all of those cards still.
Yeah. So I think the fact that there's like very few trash cards. Like, I think we saw maybe three in our four-player game. That is, like, a signal to me that this isn't the same type of, like, fine-tuned deck builder where you're creating an oiled machine.
We can kind of point out the same thing exists in DC Deck Builder.
Yeah.
I think that game, also, the cards are worth points, and you're kind of encouraged because of that to just fill your deck up with a bunch of cards.
Right.
I'm really bad at those games because I usually come at it from a standpoint of trying to make a very fine-tuned deck, and I end up like several points short of the lead because I just don't have enough stuff throughout the deck.
Now, yeah, I think that's all to say that like the lack of trashing, the sort of encouraging buying a lot of cards, that is just this type of game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for me to ask whether or not that's like good design or bad design. I think though, the way I would put it is the board doesn't have a lot that interests me by itself. So like if this is also obviously an opinion thing, but like, I think I could agree with it more if the deck building wasn't as big of a focus in the game's like components and gameplay flow.
Yeah.
Like you're doing almost more deck building than you are dungeon delving.
So like maybe if like the minor secrets did more interesting things.
Right.
Or maybe if the major secrets were at least face up so that you could like really plan a route.
Right. Or if there were more unique rooms, maybe. It just feels like, you know, early game, you can't even step into the dungeon more than two spaces before you've bought four cards.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you don't have enough boots to move that far.
Right.
And I think for a game that's about diving through a dungeon, it's really weird that you have this slow start to actually enter the first room of the dungeon.
On one hand, though, it does kind of resemble a D&D session where you're like examining every little detail of every first room. And then by the end of it, you're like, oh, I just want to kill these monsters and get out of here.
Yeah.
I just want to go back to town.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's probably not what they were going for necessarily.
That's
probably not the ideal way of opening the game out.
And so because of that, because like the first thing you do is buy cards and build your deck, it's hard for me to put this in the dungeon centric game with deck building elements rather than deck building game with dungeon elements.
Yeah.
Sort of compartment.
Yeah. Totally valid. Maybe just this style of game is just not for you, you know?
Maybe.
Like, you know, we could take it all the way back to Psychographics. I could see this not being a very, you know, a very appealing game to a type of player like yourself that likes optimizing and optimizing and such. Like a Vorthos, maybe.
Well, I mean, Vorthos is a lore friend.
Oh, not Vorthos.
A lore fiend.
Yeah, of Spike.
Yeah.
That's what I meant. Yeah. But, you know, if you're the type of person that likes the random chance, what will I draw this turn? Or just like having a big pile of cards in front of them. You just like having a lot of stuff. Then this could be a good game for you. And that's a totally valid way to feel about this game.
Yeah. This is a game that encourages hoarding treasure.
Yes. Which
it's kind of fitting.
I play D&D with those types, and, you know, it's fine. To each their own. I do like the clock in this game. That's a really fun element. And I like that you as a player get to sort of choose when that occurs and put the pressure on other people. Not a lot of games do that. Or if they do have that, it's not nearly as suspenseful and high stakes as this one is.
Mm-hmm.
So I like the stakes in this game.
I want more competitive games with Matt Leacock style timers.
Yeah. Is that what this is?
Sort of.
Okay.
Compared to like Forbidden Island or Pandemic.
Yeah.
The type where it ramps up in like severity every time the clock strikes the hour.
Mm-hmm.
Until finally it just gets to be almost too much.
And in this game, actually too much.
Yeah.
So I like that. I like the stakes there. But a place where the stakes kind of fall short for me is with the clank. I find that drawing dice from a bag is like, I don't know, something about drawing dice from a bag, like not being able to see it, makes it feel like the chance is much harder to like wrap your mind around, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? So on one hand, like there's a lot of black dice in the bag to begin with, which makes sense because like you'll dwindle those resources down until it's mostly player dice in there or player cubes in the bag in this game that you draw from to take damage from the dragon. But I don't know. It's like I didn't feel like if I put a lot of clank in there that I was putting myself at risk throughout the game. Like I felt it at first, I think. Like I felt like, oh, that's clank. Oh, that's going in the bag. I know that's bad that it's going in the bag. But then like the end result didn't feel like, oh, this is the consequences of my actions. I didn't really feel like I suffered any consequences in the game.
Yeah.
As someone who didn't really, I never got any anti-clank, and I did buy two cards, I think, two or three cards that added even more clank throughout my deck. So like I wasn't avoiding excess clank, and I wasn't trying to take any of it back, and I still made it out alive. You know, that is because I made it out very quickly, but even still, like I made it out, and I was never really afraid for my life the way that I'm clank might be meant to make you feel.
You know, that's almost another psychographic thing. Of, like, it, on one hand, it means that you can't get a direct, like, cost-benefit analysis going, but it does mean there is this element of, like, tension every time a cube is drawn. And the fact that, like, you have more cubes or less cubes, or the fact that you can't tell if you have more, I don't know if that matters as much as the anticipation of whose cube will get drawn.
Mm-hmm. To me, it didn't. Like, to me, not being able to know how many of my cubes were in there, or, like, what portion of that bag are my cubes? Like, by not knowing that, I, like, was not really that worried going into the game.
I wasn't worried, but only because I knew that I was getting those cards that let me reduce my clank.
Gotcha.
And by reducing clank, I knew I had fewer cubes than everybody else.
Well, I can say, as a clanker, I did not feel the pressure. And so, in the end, that made it feel like the cards that did generate clank, like, that wasn't really a downside. Like, there was a card that was out on the field that was, like, draw three, add two clank, or something like that. And I was like, heck yeah.
Yeah.
Like, of course I want that card. That card has no downside.
It's very dubiously a risk, because somebody else's clank could just get drawn anyways.
Sure. And then, there wasn't a lot of anti-clank, so it didn't really feel like I should even worry about being careful, because, I mean, you were getting it all, so I guess maybe if I had played with other people, I might have had a chance to get one or two of those cards. Mm-hmm. But even still, like, they didn't come up very often, so it didn't feel like the game wanted me to care about it all that much.
Yeah.
And also, in a four-player game, it was just really difficult to be in a situation to even draw them. So the clank, the namesake of the game, didn't really have the impact that I thought it would going into it.
You know, it's funny. So there's multiple versions of this game with different themes.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that the underwater clank was the original version of clank, because in my head, a diver suit like sounded more like something that would go clank than this.
No, those go clunk.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Because
you sunk in them.
Yeah, you sunk in the clunk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's hard for me to view something like, you know, more traditional armor in this. When I think of D&D, I think of like chainmail and maneuverable armor. And with the whole boots aspect, it's hard for me to picture the character's armor going clank.
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
I guess so.
I don't find the name quite associative.
Yeah. I guess maybe one thing though, just to their credit, is that it's very easy to remember, and it it makes it easy to just digest the mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a card will just say plus one clank and you know exactly what that means.
Yeah, I do think the idea of like making noise that later becomes damage mm-hmm. is well represented mechanically.
Yeah,
it's not immediately damage. You are just angering the dragon.
Yeah, I to the mechanic's credit, it's easy to like digest and interpret and understand like, oh, these are the. You make the noise, the dragon comes, you get clank, you get punished later, or you're more likely to get punished later. Yeah, it just didn't, the chances were, the end result to me was that I did not feel like I was really punishing myself. I was really, like, making bad decisions by generating clank. It was like, whatever. Yeah. But maybe that's just me, and maybe that's just the playthrough we had.
Maybe. How do you feel about the board?
Oh, yes.
This is sort of the thing I still can't wrap my head around is how I feel about the board.
I think that the board is hard to parse.
Yeah.
So, like, for example, the symbols are pretty small on the passageways, but they're very important because they're sometimes going one way and there's sometimes a key that has a lock to the passage that you're meaning to go through, which means that, like, at a glance, it's really difficult to figure out what direction you're going.
Yeah. Now,
when you end up playing this game, you know that, like, your route ends up, it takes a long time to move through the dungeon because you can only move so many spaces per turn and you have to stop at these caves and you know, you need two boots to go through there, but you only have one left at the end of your turn, so you can't move any further. So you do, like, really inch through this dungeon, which gives you the time to plan where you're going to go next. But, you don't really you don't really get the feeling that you're, like, jumping in and dashing straight for the treasure and then running out. Like, you're really crawling along, which is sort of a flavor disconnect. But, I'm not so excited to plan my route in this game because it seems like it's really tedious to try and plan your route. And that goes back to the point you made earlier where it's way more about the deck building than it is about the dungeon delving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is just another way that the game weights those things because it's like, yeah, there is a dungeon to be delved, but good luck figuring out which way you should go.
There's a lot of pathways that are very similar, and it's hard for me to tell what the exact difference between them is, not in terms of what I need to do, but when I would need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it feels like it's just if you have the resources to go down a path, that's the path you're meant to go. Like, it doesn't feel like there's a pathway that is better for, you know, swords or better for having more boots. But also it doesn't feel like there is a conscious decision to even those out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's really hard to tell why each symbol was placed where it is. Like, some major secrets have, like, a lot of pieces connecting them. And so I guess that makes sense for the major secrets. But then, like, in order to get to a heart from one of the shops, you can either pass through, like, two locked doors with a total of three monsters, and you can have to pass through a cave, or you can pass through two monsters and two boots. And so, like, is the actual cost then, like, two boots equal to a lock? Or, yeah, I don't know. Also, the board wraps around.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
Yeah, I did know that.
I didn't notice that until the end of the game we played.
Right.
That the board wraps and there's symbols on either end, but I think it just means you spend that resource once. No, it's not even a symbol. It's an arrow.
Yeah, it's an arrow.
It's like a hand.
Yeah, I was like, what is that arrow pointing to? And then I realized it was on the other side of the board around the same level. Yeah, the board wraps, which is also really weird.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't have to do that because, like, why not just put the highest costing artifact just all the way in the opposite corner of the one that you enter the dungeon in rather than making them wrap around and therefore, like, technically the center of the bottom is the furthest from the top.
Yeah. The usage of height is really awkward.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't feel like there is a clear sort of amount of space that is shared by the rooms. Like, for example, if you want to go to the basement, the fourth basement level, you can go down three steps to enter one of the shops, or you can go down three steps to grab an artifact, but below that is also a shop that's on the same level as the other shop that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you're going to this, like, half step between them, but that half step is, like, the same height as the shop in terms of, like, what I'm trying to say is that the board is confusing not just because it has a lot of information, but because it's not exactly evenly, like, distributed, or it's not consistently distributed.
I think
Does that make sense?
I think the problem that I'm having is just that a lot of rooms can be really close to other rooms or hallways that they're not connected to.
Yeah.
And that is also jarring and confusing and difficult to parse at a glance. Like, I think everything on this board feels like it needs a little more room. And then, sort of to your point, I feel like some of the things just need to be aligned a little bit better, like on a grid or something.
Yeah.
Like, I get the impulse to make things kind of look organic and, like, kind of staggered in interesting ways, but it would be much easier to parse if everything was more on, like, a grid.
Yeah.
And there was just enough room for all these icons to breathe. Yeah, I think, as a graphic designer, even, like, it needs a little bit of tweaking all over just to align everything. Like, man, I kind of want to just get in there.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're not paying me.
Yeah.
It
does make me more interested to go back and play through the later versions.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have Clank in Space, I'm pretty sure. And I'd be interested to see how that differs from this one.
Yeah.
Now that I've gone back and seen the original.
I've heard from sources that Clank in Space is better than Clank. So, yeah, I want to mention or bring that up again in one sec. But I do want to say, I kind of want to make the reverse point again. Like, I mentioned that, like, because the dungeon is hard to parse, it puts greater emphasis on the deck building. But then, sort of looking at that from another perspective, because the dungeon is hard to parse, you have to spend a lot more time focusing on it. But the deck building is the more important part of the game. You should, like, if the game is mostly about deck building, which it is, because we've talked about that, it feels like most of your turn should be spent thinking about what cards to buy. But because it takes so long to figure out where you're going in the dungeon, that takes up a lot of your turn.
Mm-hmm.
When that's not necessarily the most fun part of the game.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I feel like the board design, if it were just a little bit better, it would go a long way.
Mm-hmm.
Just have a little more room to and be a little bit easier to parse at a glance. Okay. All right, I think that does it for my design notes.
Yeah, same for me.
Okay, then that will be our discussion on Clank. And like we mentioned, I think we've played Clank in Space. It's been a while, though, and we still own that copy. So I suppose you, the listener, if you're interested in hearing our thoughts on Clank in Space, feel free to hit us up on social media.
Yeah.
All right, thanks for listening.
See ya.